millions of families from coast to coast and listen to America's favorite, the American Broadcasting Company's Breakfast Club with Don McNeil.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning to ya. We woke up bright and early. Just a howdy do ya. Coffee's on, the cereal, the bacon, and the skillet. Eddie Ballantyne and the boys have tunes to fill it. So come on, gang, let's take a poll of this day's meeting. Line up, kids, I'll call the roll and sing your greeting. Nancy Martin.
Once upon a time, in an America not yet disillusioned by lost wars and failed presidencies, there was a radio program that sought to make a neighborhood of the nation. It was the creation of a man who would become a broadcasting legend, Don McNeil. Don McNeil's Breakfast Club would last for more than three decades and remain as a nostalgic touchstone for two generations of Americans. In this accomplishment, the show and its star made important contributions not just to broadcasting, but also to the art of communication and the self-image of a society. My guest is John Doolittle, author of Don McNeil and His Breakfast Club. John, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was a pleasure to read the book. And, you know, I think one of the first questions I have to ask you this is this, John. A program lasts on radio for 35 years. That's remarkable in itself. And as you read the book, you say, you know, why did that happen? You know, what was the root of that? And one guess I have is that Don McNeil tapped into what we might call mainstream Americanness. I mean, very much in the way that Norman Rockwell would paint or Jimmy Stewart might act. Does that make any sense?
It certainly does. And George, I asked a woman that was a guest on his show for about 25 years, and she happened to be on the last program. A very ordinary woman, but with a wonderful sense of life and humor. Her name was Stormy Babula. And I asked her on the phone. I called her about 2 years ago when I was researching the book, and I said, what was your opinion of Don McNeil? And all she said to me was, he was an honest man.
Yeah. Tell me this, John. One of the other curiosities I had concerned the origins of the program in this sense. He, like Norman Corwin or Orson Welles, had the, to me, great, wonderful adventure, if you will, of coming into this when radio was in its infancy. I wonder about that as kind of an influence in the work that he did and continued to do for 35 years, and also the fact that as a backdrop for the most powerful years of his program, he had the Great Depression and World War II, and how all those kinds of circumstances, if you will, influenced his effect on the American public. What did it mean to the nation to have radio broadcasting in the 30s and 40s?
Well, obviously in the 30s we have all those events over in Europe and people who craft broadcast news, H.V. Kaltenborn telling people what that the phony war in Europe was like, right. And then the rise of Hitler. And then from Pearl Harbor on, I guess, the drama of World mm-hmm. War II. And I have listened to and been fortunate enough to get Breakfast Club recordings that were made on the day after Pearl Harbor was hit, or the morning of Franklin Roosevelt's funeral, or the day in May when Germany pretty much surrendered in 1945. And the program quickly moves from this lighthearted morning alarm clock for America to a kind of chapel where we all sit together mm-hmm. and pray, or we hope for the best. And there was a kindred spirit that I think the program was quite successful, probably because it had singers and music, mm-hmm. and it wasn't so much words as right. hymns, as patriotic songs.
John, I think the best thing I can do for our audience at this point is to let them hear an excerpt from this program, specifically the one on Victory in New York Day, which I think will give them a sense
from our Blue Network
of the character
newsroom
of what
in New York.
He did.
Keep tuned to this station for further developments. We now resume our regularly scheduled program.
Look at all those faces, Don.
Yeah.
They've changed a little bit, haven't they?
They certainly have. Everybody's got a little smile contained in there that it's very hard to contain, as a matter of fact. I think perhaps we ought to do this. You ought to do it at your home, too. Before we get down to any really serious discussion of the implications of this day, if today is officially it, and we haven't had that announcement, as you heard, as yet, I think perhaps it'd be nice if you all got a good yell out of your system right now, and then we can get back to normal here for a few minutes. Sitting there trying to contain yourself.
Now you're talking, kid.
Yeah. Let's let off steam and have one good yell here for a second.
Yay!
All right, fine. That
was a dandy.
Yeah, that was
put
a
the
beat.
Roof back on, we can go on.
You know, I was struggling, reading the book and thinking about having a conversation with you, to try to come up with an example or two of modern-day personalities in broadcasting or anywhere else that might suggest to an audience that hasn't heard him some of those stylistic elements. And let me try a couple of examples and see what you think of them. I thought of two people in particular. Actually, one a former president, Ronald Reagan. There's a quality of that Reagan Morning in America sort of appeal, if you remember the, I guess it was the 1980 election, or the 84 election, when he used that kind of theme and that approach as only he could do in his way, that really suggested to me the spirit, if he was, not the style of Don McNeil. But in a more contemporary example, directly from radio, I was thinking of Garrison Keillor with the Prairie Home Companion, as at least in that same school.
When McNeil does something on a formal presentation scale, such as his recording Make America Proud of You, which he had these, I think, 1,500 or more young teenagers in Chicago go into the Shrine Auditorium and record this song, Make America Proud of You. It was really something, and McNeil does the narration. And yes, there I think he has a public presence, perhaps a bit like Reagan, in its style and reserve. I was going to say Oprah Winfrey or somebody like Phil Donahue, because they're really using that audience as a way to extend their ideas. And I think McNeil liked to do that to extend his show. Garrison Keillor normally is kind of the star and his own guest, if you will. Except lately I've been listening to him, and he will not only talk about somebody with the pot of beans on, and I forgot to turn them off, but he'll actually say, now, where are you from? And the person will say, well, I'm from Grand Rapids or wherever. Yeah. So there's a bit of that. I would say Garrison Keillor, Will Rogers, Norman Rockwell, kind of in a blender, comes out Don McNeil.
Say that again. That's worth repeating. Garrison Keillor.
Will Rogers and Norman Rockwell.
Gosh, that's an excellent characterization. John, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is John Doolittle, author of Don McNeil and His Breakfast Club, published by the University of Notre Dame Press. As we said earlier, John, this program was very much an extension of Don McNeil. It was not a stretch in any sense. So let's talk a bit about those qualities. He's, again, to put a, I hope not too, a simplistic phrase on this, almost a quintessential Midwesterner, isn't he? I mean, the Marquette University, the...
He sounds it.
Yeah.
He has that Midwestern lilt to his voice, really a kind of upper Midwest Wisconsin lilt, which never leaves him.
Right. And is evident, that personality, that lilt, that voice, that style, that everything, as early as Marquette University. I mean, I was struck by, I guess he's a very talented cartoonist before he even turns to broadcasting. But the same sense of humor and gentle satire, not cruel satire, is pretty constant.
That's true. Yeah, if you look at those early cartoons he did when he was editing the school yearbook at Marquette, that comes through.
In fairness, John Doolittle, I have to ask you this question as well, because here's a man who, again, it bears repeating, maintains a radio program for 35 years. And those are pretty eventful years. In addition to World War II, and that would be plenty right there, there's the Cold War, as well as the Korean War, which the Korean War is part of the Cold War. And we're having some pretty tense times domestically. But Don McNeil pretty rigorously stays away from politics, doesn't he?
Yeah, his philosophy was you get the news right before my show, and you can get it after my show, so you don't tune in to me for public affairs.
With one exception, there is an intervention he makes on the school prayer issue.
The Supreme Court in the early 60s decided that school prayer was not among those rights afforded in the Bill of Rights. And McNeil speaks up very strongly about that. And he gets criticized for it. Mm-hmm. And he probably, in many people's minds, is put into a certain kind of camp because of that. But it was very consistent with the programming that he had done since World War II when he started the prayer.
You know, it's, I'll come back to school prayer in just a moment. You know, it's also telling in the same sense of what you just said about he felt the news came before and after rather than on the program, that on the occasion where he does have a Mr. Jenkins, I believe, who was a counsel to Senator McCarthy,
right.
And I only have to say the name Senator McCarthy for people still to know what that was all about. That whole moment before the mic with Don McNeil was intensely apolitical, it seemed.
More or less. Mm-hmm. A woman in the audience asked Jenkins what he thought about Joe McCarthy's tactics, and Jenkins, who was brought in kind of like a Kenneth Starr to level the field and to see if there was anything going wrong, was fairly noncommittal. McNeil was very diplomatic with him, and Jenkins said to him in the program, "Well, Don, I don't worry about America when I see people like you and members of your..." It was a morning when the McNeil's family was visiting the show, and he said, "When I see your sons and your wife, I don't worry about America." So there was a... I guess there was a bit of a political agenda there of some kind.
Can I bear on that question one more moment, John?
Sure.
Even though he kept politics out of things in an overt way, I think we'd both agree on that, he did have his own attitudes, didn't he? I mean, it seems to me there was a... Certainly a distaste for communism and probably for left-wing politics as an expression of that.
To be honest with you, I never got wind of that.
Mm.
What I did pick up, and I guess we could look at it, I think in fairness we should look at it in a time frame of when it occurred, say 1948 or 1952. He was very pro-family. He would always ask somebody, either a guest or a member of his staff or a member of the band, he would say, "Well, how's your family? Are you married? Do you have children?" So that was very important. And I think he continually, in his dealings with people and in his humor, presented a kind of a evenness, an equality, an acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Which had a kind of a meta-communication to people.
So what we would say, or what you might be telling me and our listening audience, is that this is a man who was driven, if you will, by a set of very consistent family values, moral values.
Yes.
And that was his message.
I asked his sister, who's still living, she's, I think, 8 years younger than Don. I said, he really got this thing going and worked very hard. He was not sponsored for 7 years, and he worked hard to get the network to find sponsors, and eventually when he got sponsors, he became quite wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And Agnes, his sister, said, "Well, you got to realize that Don McNeil's father pretty much lost his business just before the Depression. It wasn't clear whether Don would even have enough money to finish his undergraduate schooling, so he goes to work at the newspaper as a cartoonist and then gets a job on the air. And he is starting off in his career, and he lands a job that's pretty good out in San Francisco, and after I think 13 weeks, it's canceled. So he then is facing a bit of what his father faced.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this strong drive to succeed, to provide for his family in a way that his father was not able to provide for him.
With that example, I think what you emphasize once again is the intertwining of life and art. I mean, throughout, I mean, he's so much a product of not just the values we mentioned, but the experiences he had.
That's right.
It seems to be pretty seamless.
So I think that was his motivation, mm-hmm. to succeed, to be a... he was loyal. He was loyal to his staff. I mean, he had the band leader, Eddie Valentine, was with him all 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
The pianist, Bill Kranz, was there for most of it. So he was very loyal to his people. He wanted to live by the rules. those good Midwestern middle-class values.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one way also, anecdotally adding to that, was when he has his own little retreat, if you will, himself hideaway, I guess he calls it.
That's right.
Which is a place you go to be away from things. That's the normal meaning of a retreat. He quickly turns that into at least a part-time a kids' camp for underprivileged children of all backgrounds to enjoy. We're talking about his success, John Doolittle, but let's mention something that didn't succeed very well, and that's the television ventures. So the question is pretty straightforward. Why did he not either direct TV broadcasts, the radio programs, or simulcast? And none of those things seem to work very well.
I think there are two answers for that. The first one would be that ABC television was struggling and pretty much struggled from its birth in the late 40s until the Fonz came along in 1975. I think Rune Arledge with the Olympics and the Fonz were the two things that really put ABC TV on its feet. Sponsors of early shows like McNeil's were not able to get the clearances on the number of stations around the country, so they were unhappy. That's part of the answer. The other part is Don didn't look the way he sounded. I mean, he sounded like your neighbor, your brother, but he didn't look it. He looked like a vice president of a bank.
Right. Uh-huh. And the visual, of course, is dominant, as we all know, in television.
He has said, when asked this question, that he was always better when he was in total control. He had the microphone in his hand. He could control the guest. And I've seen him give cues on simulcast to the orchestra when they should pick up a stinger, ending a bit. In television, he didn't have all that control. Yeah. He had a farm it out to people.
Well, this, to me, as I read it and thought about it, I mean, it just really does underscore the difference between these two media. Because I guess communicating warmth and charisma and all these kinds of things on television is supposed to be so vitally important. He really had those things. And yet, as you point out, because he didn't, in an image sense, immediately project them, that was probably quite a hurdle.
Now, I've seen him when he was substituting for Gary Moore on I've Got a Secret, and he's great. Mm-hmm. I mean, in timing and the little quips and all of that, but doing his own show on television. Now, other critics said that he was handled too much, and if left to his own devices, the show would have succeeded a little better.
When you mentioned Gary Moore, I think it's worth pointing out that in addition to the staff that he made, kind of an extended family, and the importance of his own family to everything he did, the vast number of other famous artists who would sort of pass through the Breakfast Club as guest hosts or guests is quite extensive.
Well, number one is Fran Allison, who
exactly.
was Aunt Fanny, and with him for many, many years, and they were a delightful team. And then he really had some of the very best people in radio, writers, producers, and a damn good orchestra backing him up. Really good music.
And again, with that orchestra, the live orchestra in the studio, on stage, every performance. I think you made a point of this earlier, but the allegiance, the length of time people would stay with him, the institutionalization, if you will, of the entire operation is
I talked to a musician who's in Chicago. He's still alive. He was with the orchestra, and he had had a good musical career. He'd played Las Vegas and stuff like that. And he said, reflecting, the best time of his life was getting up those mornings and being on the staff member of the Breakfast Club band.
That's high praise, because that meant getting up at 4:30 in many instances.
Not quite that early, but early.
Early enough.
Yeah.
John, in addition to being the author of this book, you're also a professor of broadcast communications at American University. So.
Mm-hmm.
You teach as well as write, and you teach right in the field that you yourself have an extensive past in. So I wonder what you teach about Don McNeil, or what influence he might have on the courses, the classes, the students you deal with.
Bear with me. The book just came out, and most of my teaching really involves getting people prepared for careers in television and some radio. But more and more, the students are interested in radio.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it will have a bearing. I also teach a course in the history of broadcast news, and although, certainly the segments that I have that talked about the war and the aftermath of Pearl Harbor are going to be part of that.
He himself taught, didn't he, after he retired in, I guess, 1968 at his alma mater, Marquette, and possibly Notre Dame, I'm not
he
sure.
Did.
He did.
He taught seminars there, and I talked to people who knew him when he was doing that up at Marquette, and they said he really came alive in the classroom, and there was always a sparkle that he brought to the class.
What kind of message? I guess it might have been spontaneity on behind the mic, or I mean, what was he trying to get them to understand?
I've looked at the syllabi, and what he wanted them to do is to do some community-based interviews and programming, and to think of the audience in terms of what the audience needs. Mm-hmm. And he was a pretty good coach.
Yeah,
he really was.
I could imagine that. Pretty good coach, John Doolittle. Perhaps pretty good critic, too, because he retired. The last Breakfast Show was in 1968. He went off the air with it. He did do some additional radio after that and the teaching. And then, of course, he passed away in 1996. Is that right, 96?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
But weren't his views about radio, John, rather scathing in the later years, or at least somewhat critical?
Yeah, they were. He wasn't terribly impressed by, he would not be impressed by the shock jocks and the people who were so into themselves that they really weren't very considerate of the audience. On that last show you talked about in 68, in an interview he said he was recovering from a very bad cold, and they were doing musical numbers that each member of the staff had written. And there was one that was written for him that was something like the sneezing polka. And he said, you know, I was nervous about doing that because I didn't want to offend people who had some bronchial problems. Mm. And he felt that way about making fun of Vietnam or making any statements that would be disparaging about any individual, because he didn't think that was fair. And he looked at radio the way it was becoming a more fragmented medium, and he was not terribly happy with that. At the same time, in a memory time that he gave here in Washington during the NAB conference in 1965, the broadcast from the Mayflower Hotel, he did a wonderful tribute to radio and the power of radio and the power of words and thoughts and theater of the mind versus what you see on the screen.
Mm, that's a very moving answer. You know, it's very interesting to me that as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, John Doolittle, as I said, I read the book with a kind of a 21st century sensibility, which I also try to resist because, you know, when I get too cynical, you say, well, where's the flaw? What's he doing? And you don't find any. And the word you're left with, at least a couple of them, are sincerity and integrity in terms of the man. And, of course, it gets reflected in what he does. But rather than my blabbering on, I'd love to ask you as we conclude what you think his legacy is. What did the fact that this program was on the air for 35 years mean and still mean to us?
I just like radio, and I attended the Breakfast Club as a kid. I'm from Chicago, and I was just very taken by the style and the magnificence of this hour-long show. So it was something that interested me. But in the process of talking about it with you and with others and asking myself some questions, I've come face-to-face with people's memory of what the Breakfast Club and Don McNeil was to them. And even though they don't talk about it, it's still part of their reservoir. And it's been really exciting for me to tap that and experience that. It's like I have entered a chamber in people's memory and lives. Mm. And maybe the best way I can leave you with is somebody contacted me on the internet and said, would you like a copy of an 8mm black and white film of my family's journey from New Jersey to Chicago in 1946? And we went to the Merchandise Mart and watched The Breakfast Club. And he sent that to me. And I have 3 minutes of black and white Breakfast Club, 1946. And it's amazing to see. And what it meant to people.
I think that's a great answer, too. And with that, to remind us of the power of this meeting to make a difference in lives for the entire life of those who listen or see. So for that, and for the book itself, thank you very much, John Doolittle, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Judge.
Well, you know, the last couple days when I've been home fighting that flu, I thought to myself, I ought to write something out real fancy as my farewell. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, if I haven't said all I've got to say and said it several times in the last 35 and a half years, it's too late now. I guess everybody knows how I feel about how wonderful people have been to me and kept me on the air all these years. And so I thought I'll just say a few words from the heart, and after all, if there's been any secret to success in this show, it's been that, believability, because, as the man said, I do stumble around, I do make mistakes, but I mean everything I say, and I have all these years, and nothing I could say would mean more than having all of you, many of you, sometimes three generations of you, with me all these years. And so I hope you'll be hearing me and seeing me hither and yon someplace. I wish you all the greatest of success and happiness. And I think perhaps the best way to leave would be with our moment of silent prayer, in which I've always asked you, each in his own words, each in his own way, for a free world united in peace. Let us bow our heads and pray. Amen. And if you want peace where you are, don't ever forget Don McNeil and the gang saying so long, and be good to your neighbor.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was John Doolittle. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's RADIODIAL@AOL.com.